Hello everybody, I'd like to welcome you to George Steffemo's speech, Open Coding Innovation. He graduated with a Master of Business Administration, and he did his master thesis on the Linux community process, and he's been caring about these issues, how those community processes work further on, and that's what basically his speech is about. George Steffemo.
Thanks everyone for being here. I'm George. Unfortunately, I've been ill for the last week, therefore my voice is a bit blurred, my throat's a bit sore. If you have any problem whatsoever with my presentation, if my pace is too fast, if I'm saying nonsense, if you want to ask me something or if you want to make any comment, if you want me to clarify anything, please do not hesitate to stop me and say that again, or I have a problem with that. The presentation is called Open Coding Innovation, and it's an attempt to analyze whether technology should be put into use for the greater common well-being and not just to push products and services to stimulate consumer demand. I base my analysis on the Linux development process and how Linux is being deployed either by corporations, governments. Therefore, I'm briefly mentioning some business models. The unfortunate part is that I find it very hard to put my mind, my thought, into a linear argument. Therefore, some themes pervade the presentation might be a bit puzzling. I advise you to stop me at any moment you feel I'm saying nonsense. I mean, lots of people say that to me. I'll go on with a brief introduction about what constitutes the elements of a well-tuned financial or economic social system thereof. Mankind has progressed mainly because of its ability to share risks and collaboratively solve problems that we all face. Therefore, we need knowledge. Knowledge is not just an abstract sense. I'll go on with that. I forgot. I mean, that's about social capital. I just said that we need an ability, a capacity to solve problems all together, and that it's not just an abstract form of institutionalized saying. It's something that's needed to involve people into entrepreneurial activities and social public activities as well. Had gone on to knowledge, which is not also an abstract term. I like to differentiate between technical know-how and social know-how, which means we also need to know how to create technical services and products, and also how to create institutions, mainly public institutions, that foster the adoption of technology for greater well-being. The dilemma, I'm saying, I mean, there are some circumstances in our life that we've reached that we should decide upon a trade-off. The Human Genome Project is an example, and the DNA, of course. Do you trust organizations or the government to push that forward? Thereof, we should be all involved, and either or both organizations and the governments involved in the DNA should have community accountability. People should be involved. Go to financial markets and trade. Why do we need financial markets? Trade basically pushes the boundaries of well-being if it's well-tuned and it aims at facilitating life, not just people to get richer and breed greed. That's the term I like, from shareholders, which means the ones who own the shares of public companies, to stakeholders. Stakeholders include the environment, even future generations, according to some theorists. That's a nice phrase, creative accounting, which means financial malpractices and a rip-off to management accountability. We all know the cases of Enron, Arthur Andersen, genetically modified food. I'm not going to go into it in any detail. What about technological innovation? What's the place of technology in that context? When I was a student, we always used to differentiate technology according to whether it satisfies a clearly identified market need or whether it's only for the sake of pushing that technology. For example, some say that the MP3 satisfied people's need to have a more portable, more compact technology, and others say that since it was developed for video formats, it was technology push. Basically, the point is market pulls satisfies a need we already know, and technology push tries to create a new need that the technology will be called to satisfy. It's the same with disruptive and sustaining innovation. Sustaining innovation builds on top of another and aims at satisfying a need in a better way, and disruptive is a technology that creates a wholly new industry. Europe versus America. I'm not trying to say that we Europeans are good people and Americans are bad, despite the common belief that nowadays most people criticize the States. I'm just trying to say that in the States, technology is being integrated in the belief that progress is so tightly linked to technology. Therefore, we should value technology for the sake of technology. People who went to places where nuclear experiments had taken place years ago, nowadays setting us tourist attractions, say, it's so nice in places where technology has been growing. Whereas in Europe, there's no equivalent. All I'm saying is that the community should provoke a dialogue whether technology commits oneself to deliver new technology to be old at, or is technology serving human needs and societal needs. That's, is it just helpful or dynamic and confusing? Nowadays, so many people find the pace of technology to be unmatched by the pace of institutional innovation, and that's mainly why so many people feel confused and betrayed by the rate of technological innovation. I had this discussion with, where is it, Michael? Never mind. Some say, some surveys, some researchers claim that Napster and the peer-to-peer phenomenon has actually stimulated consumer demand for new records, for new CDs, and that unless it had been for technologies just like Rockstar, or Napster, Audio Galaxy, people would have stopped buying CDs, and that kind of technology creates awareness of new artists. But it does not have to mean that technology should just create consumer demand for the newer versions of CD players and MP3s, but it should be used for environmental purposes. I mean, a technology just like peer-to-peer has tremendous potential to cut down on the social costs and the environmental costs of technological growth. Short introduction to organizations. Some lecturers of mine in the past business schools could not even answer this question. Why organizations exist. They used to say, what do you mean? Why organizations exist? I mean, they exist because they're organizations. Organizations exist to coordinate people. In countries where organizations do not prevail, for example, in Greece, where I come from, if you want to have your place fitted with wooden furniture, you have to call a technician and not an organization the way it is in the United Kingdom. Organizations serve to coordinate people and also serve to store organizational memory, routines, procedures that would have been difficult to replicate instantly. Just like in the libre software world, that would say you do not have to invent the wheel. So by having an organization, you can store knowledge somewhere so as not to reinvent the wheel. Currently, the centralized mindset reigns. We'll get back to that later on. And organization, as we said, aids knowledge not to have to be reinvented all the time. What determines the organizational structure? And organization does not have to be tens of people in a building, white building with nice offices. The things that define structure is communication, transportation, and transaction costs, which of course have been affected by technology, altered by technology and social needs. In ancient Greece, there were the Argonauts. People go together for a specific project, got a nice ship, and a nice shipment, got their objective, and once the mission was done, the project team disbanded. Contemporary analogies, the Hollywood and Silicon Valley, fostered by institutional innovation. Not so much in the Hollywood nowadays, but people go together for a specific mission, specific project, a film, and work quite closely with each other for a specific time, period of time, and once the film is released, they go on to another assignment, another mission, another film. Introduction to organizations. I had this discussion with Robert Wattman this morning. What is hierarchy? Hierarchy was invented or coined as a term nearly 4,000 years ago by an ancient Greek judge, and is modeled on the gods of Olympus, the ancient Greek gods, which were made in reflection of mankind. They made sins, they made love, they had passions, there was a community of intrigue. The environment is stable, the processes are known, the output is given. That's the premise on which hierarchy is built. Do you think that in the software industry the environment is stable, for example? No. Thanks for answering sometimes. I think no one's paying attention. Thanks. Organizations. First, organizations with many layers of hierarchy, where the army and the church. Anyone who's ever joined the army, I think, knows the purpose. Knowledge should not flow out of the context of operation. The first person who shaped the minds of organizational workers and affected organizational life was Frederick Taylor. He was a cripple. He had problems with his body. Therefore, he had plenty of time to focus on the production process. He realized that the most essential component was technical know-how, and at the time, the only way to gain access to this knowledge was to become a learner next to someone who already possessed that knowledge. Therefore, he embarked on his famous time and motion studies. He had some white cards and had been written down and sketching how people had been performing special and not so special tasks. Therefore, if the production process could be broken down into many explicit steps, this knowledge could be disseminated. The ironic thing is that he grasped the knowledge of knowledge, but made the transition to the industrial organization a reality. Fayol, perhaps some of you are familiar with Fayol's theory. He's the most known management theorist. He said two things: we need rules and breakdown in communication results due to hierarchic bureaucracy. And he used this example that if employee E wants to contact employee O, he has to go up the ladder, get permission. The one above him has to get permission as well. Therefore, he goes up the triangle and down, which is waste of time, waste of costs, and most of the times due to friction. What he wanted to say in the very beginning gets modified, gets altered. And we end up with Weber. Modern management science is founded on Weber's account of bureaucracy. He was really evangelizing bureaucracy because said nowadays, that was 1984, we need clear rules and people should be regarded as stupid because knowledge was not widely available. Very few people had been attending universities, had access to knowledge without interference of central authorities. There was no internet. You could retrieve, search for information, and many people had been illiterate at the time. Therefore, an organizational framework for cogs or stupid people had to be put into action. But things have changed. And our friend Henry Ford, with the famous assembly line, he created a revolution in the global car industry. any color they want, as long as black. We all know that even though the salaries at the time had been pretty good, according to the employees, the organization had been even invading into the privacy of their own homes. And there is this famous story where one employee needed to go to the toilet, take a piss. So he asked his supervisor, excuse me, sir, may I go to the toilet for a second? I'll be right back. And he told him, look, you cannot. You cannot go to the toilet, not even for a minute, because if you leave the assembly line, your position, the whole system comes to a halt and collapses. Toyota, he was a real guy, had paid a visit in the late 50s to the Detroit plant, in the Ford plant. He realized, he saw many things to marvel. He liked these efficiency gains of bureaucracy. But because in Japan, many different models of cars were needed, he realized that a different model would have been put into work in Japan. Japan is based on closed forms of trust, which enable collaboration between themselves. They do not like collaborating with foreigners, that's a different thing. But they collaborate very closely with their own suppliers. The whole system seeks to ensure product quality and employee empowerment in the form of job rotation, which means one day you might be working to fix problem A, but next day you'll be working on a completely different in scope and scale project in order to get more skills, become more tied with your co-workers, and the whole words used for them had been trying to provoke a sense of family and self-empowerment. What Lib software has anything got to do with management and organizations? I think all of us, that's why we are here, agree that Libre software can be applied to other areas of social and economic activity. And it's not just about software engineering. And it's not a miracle that projects just like Linux have been so successful. In the very beginning, some people would have said, this is an anarchy. How does it work? How these people coordinate their input and output? We'll see now why. You all know what is Libre software. Use it in any way you see fit. So you need to have access to the source code. What's the logic? I think you're also familiar with that. Software is not manufacturing industry. It's not just about selling packaged goods. And tragedy of the commons is not relevant. There is a theory that goes, it's just like these napkins of mine. If I give every single one to you, at the end of the day, I'm going to be with none. So the value of that diminishes the more people get involved and the more people take from that packet. But if we talk about digital goods, then their value is dependent upon the network. The classic example is the telephone. If I'm the only person in Berlin who's owning a telephone, what's the use for it? Am I going to call myself? But if everyone is having a telephone, then the value of the product, as if the telephone, rises. And of course, gives rise to new business models. We have two main development models in the software industry, according to Eric Raymond, the cathedral and the bazaar. The cathedral is a closed system, which means, in the case of Microsoft, the employee, only 3% of the people who apply, whereas in the Libre software world, everyone who wants to contribute is welcomed. Most product development is done at one site, coordination by hierarchy, quadratic complexity. This is also known in the computer world as Brooks' Law. Frederick Brooks had been a project manager at IBM and basically said that the more developers you add at a late stage of a project, the more complexity you're going to expect for, the more bugs, and the project is not going to end up on time. The example I like is in a kitchen. If that's the space of a kitchen and you have two cooks, they will be able to coordinate themselves and produce a nice pizza perhaps. But if you add another 100 cooks into the same space, then this is going to evolve into chaos. No food will be produced. They'll probably end up fighting each other. And also clearly is that users and producers are different, are separated in the cathedral mode of software development. This is the Microsoft development model. There is a parallel process taking place. It's one of the best software engineering models, not the waterfall model. Or I mean, they know the job, absolutely they do. But it's nothing compared to the parallel development taking place in the Linux, which I'll go into in more detail in a while. The Bazaar set model on Linux, open evolutionary system. It evolves according to the wills of the community. No one dictates its evolution. People coordinate themselves. No one dictates who will do what. You have hugely diverse actors. Some people test the software. Some people characterize bugs. Some people solve and fix these bugs. Others write extensions, modules, and so on. The strange thing is that Brooks' law, the quadratic complexity, does not hold. Why? Up, it's not here. I'll tell you now why. As you probably know, there are two versions, two parallel tracks in the development of Linux. One version is stable, and one version is the cutting edge, aspiring to provide cutting edge developers with something to work on and build on. The point is that in all decision-making processes, in every situation where we need to decide where to allocate our resources, we face a trade-off. Physicists call it the trade-off of exploration versus exploitation. Exploitation means we have an existing design, we allocate our resources to that to make it even better, more perhaps environmentally sensible, but we have the design, it's an existing design, and we want to make it better. It's sustaining innovation. And exploration means exploring new frontiers, taking that design, scrap it, and working on an entirely new design that might come up to be good, might come up to be bad. We don't know. We're just exploring the future. In the case of Linux, this trade-off is non-existent. People who want to work on perfecting the existing design can do so, and people who want to explore the future are also welcomed. Therefore, there is no possibility for forking, and this trade-off, which is fundamental in all systems and their ability to evolve, is being defied. Another innovation of Linus Torvalds, the benevolent leader of the Linux community, is that by releasing early and often software, you stimulate the community and reward the people who contribute. Work done is of superb quality. Apparently, you must be using Linux or other free software. If it has reached a point of maturity the way Linux has, then apparently it's of good quality. Not use it. If some work of a hacker is not of the best quality possible, we've got also this self-selection of tasks, which means, let's give an example with regard to the Linux project. There are people just like Alan Cox who work around Linux, around the community, and they're being recognized as experts, not as owners by the community. Whatsoever, if their work sometime stops to be that good and so highly regarded by the community, someone else will probably replace them. And we see instances where Linus Torvalds had his own say with regard to some technical obscure matter, and Alan Cox, in specific case I'm aware of, had his own mind, and the community got to back Alan Cox because it's based on merit, it's based on technical skills, and it's based on explaining and showing something, how it works in practice. It's not based on status. We've got this management accountability. Every decision-making activities take place out there in the open. Anyone can challenge what's been said and add his opinion. And the trusted lieutenants are the people just like Alan Cox, who emerged because of a need identified by the community. That's a nice graph. Some people get really buzzed and bummed by the whole thing. I'm trying to depict the little software community with that black circle, and above that, mailing lists, websites where people can go and see what's going on. The important thing is that the whole thing is so transparent that the developers can go directly, can drop a line to Linus Torvalds, or can go to the trusted lieutenants, which is how bug fixes are being flowing throughout the community, modifications, improvement. And the process of peer review also takes place out there in the open, in the mailing lists and websites and places dedicated to the community. We also have extreme modularity in design, clean and clear interfaces, which enable this parallel development, implying the stable version and the cutting-edge version, and decreases the need for coordination. In most industries, the attempt to standardize some processes aims at the same goal, that by having modularity in design, clear interfaces, whether we are talking about software or cars, we can cut down the cost to coordinate increasingly bigger teams of people, and also to enable parallel development to occur. The peer review process seeks to characterize all bugs very quickly, and therefore quality and security merges. That's the trade-off I stressed upon 5 minutes ago, the exploration versus exploitation trade-off. I don't need to repeat it then. And what's the greatest innovation of Linux? By treating your users as developers, you innovate. This is a graph by Tom Peters, one of the leading management consultants in the States. He showed that where users or adopters of technology and producers of technology or developers coexist harmonically, where there is this democratic conflict, then that's the site of most innovation. And most importantly, even the graph does not depict that, does not show it. If developers and users overlap, then technological growth, technology, is not just trying to sell more products and services, but it's trying to serve the need of users. By having an open infrastructure, we all know that you are to the internet and open systems, you can trust it by seeing how it works on the way down, and you can invest into it without having any doubts that some of the players might take more and never give anything back. That's actually showing why Linux will grow bigger and will enter more organizations and more desktops. By gaining more people, by attracting more people, it aims at serving more clearly identified needs. When my desktop, my Windows desktop, collapses, I have a need for a more stable, more robust desktop. Therefore, we increasingly see companies just like SUSE to provide us with a nice desktop. And at the same time, more businesses, more and more, every single day, are shifting to Linux. Advantages, the right to modify it enables unlimited tuning and improvement. You can have unprecedented adaptability. You can reach a detailed understanding of how the system works, and combined with redistribution rights, ensures that a large amount of developers will be attracted if the project is useful and fun and interesting enough. And of course, if there is a market emerging for support and customization, profits and revenue streams, business models will emerge. There is no single entity on the future of the software or the product. It depends upon if we're having a nice company. A nice example is the BIOS operating system. The organization collapsed, but they open sourced the code. Therefore, some support, even though insignificant in terms of scale when compared to the Linux, will go on. All I'm saying is that we shouldn't be locked into a user-producer or a supplier lock-in relationship if we're having open code, whether we're talking about a car. I mean, I would really favor a time when I'll be having, let's say, a nice Volkswagen, and I'll be able to go perhaps to Mercedes and say, this is a problem I'm having on the time. Can you please fix it? And they'll be able, due to modularity, to install the features I want and fix my problem. And free to save it. The BIOS situation is again prominent. Make sure it remains supported in the future. And good strategy for software or code which has been developed to serve the needs of the organization, not of a consumer or business market. We have no black boxes, and this is extremely useful for developing countries to leapfrog into the information age. And no copy fees can be asked for modified versions, of course. Ensures fast diffusion adoption, just like it happened with the internet. That's also very nice. Once Philip Hans, he's running a company selling a package, let's say, version of the Debian distribution. He told me that many times the marketing department has decided on a feature they think it's so critical, so special, that most effort, most organizational effort, is focused on that particular feature. Whereas it emerges that many users do not give a damn about it. What I mean is that a couple of months ago, I had seen this advertisement for a PDA, personal digital assistant, and it was something like 7 o'clock in the morning. You wake up, you go to the gym. I thought, if someone is that a maniac with his own body, a gymnastic freak, then he doesn't need a PDA to wake up at 7 o'clock in the morning. How many people wake up at 7 o'clock in the morning to train themselves? Not many. Then at 8 o'clock, he went on to buy, the guy featured in the advertisement, went on to buy some gift for his wife. At 9 o'clock, he went to his job as a marketing rep. Therefore, he had to prepare some presentation. 12 o'clock, lunch with Luis. 1 o'clock, I think, or 2 o'clock, the presentation to his supervisors, to his organization. And 4 o'clock, going to play football with the boys. I've never seen any of these advertisements saying, don't wake up, stay at home, have sex with Luis, which is what most... I mean, I'm having a PDA. I've never having entered 10 lines of stuff for my daily schedule. I mean, for today, it read something like, show up at Wakonok's meeting, meet new people, and have fun. It's not 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock. What I'm trying to say is that, just like many technologies, the reason that they're being developed is not the purpose why people buy them for. The most classic example is text messaging. In the beginning, most organizations thought that no one would be interested in text messaging, but it seems that 12-year-olds have proven us wrong. And that's the case with many technologies, whether we're talking about computers, PDAs, or cars. Even though most people buy cars to go to their own job or, you know, to travel, many people just buy them as a symbol of affection or of desire or to show off. Let's go on. It's a new democratic forum, the process exemplified by the Linux development, because the collective desires of the community dictate what's going to happen, when, how, and all together decide upon critical decisions. I'll skip that. It's in terms of total cost of ownership. It's mostly focused upon software. There are 6 stages: information gathering. You get information, you try to find information, to critically evaluate which software you will implement and which systems you will adopt for your own organization. Then you acquire or you create these systems, you deploy them, you train people to use them and maintain them. And if something happens and you don't like them any longer, you scrap the system and go to a newer one. A month ago, someone told me there is no difference between going from a closed source system to an open code system, and the other way around is exactly the same. I told them that if I'm having a closed source system and all my data are in that closed code system, then if I want to migrate to an open code system, then most of my data will be lost because I do not have the interfaces. I do not know how to delve into it and withdraw my data. The point is that as time goes by, more organizations, more individuals, more community-based mechanisms emerge to help people to gather information, to critically evaluate alternatives to closed source products and services. And training is a hurdle, but it's the same thing when it comes to closed source. You are going to eventually spend up some time learning how to use any software, any product. Many more are realized, as you said. You customize something to suit your own needs. KD is translated into 42 languages, perhaps nowadays into 62. I don't know. These figures are 1 year old. When libre software or the structure as manifested by the Linux development process is rational. To avoid market fragmentation, we all know the case of Unix. To dethrone a product which has locked in the market due to increasing returns, due to purposes other than technological merit. Windows is the classic example. It's not, or even videotapes. Most people say that Beta was a better product design than VHS, but VHS came to prevalence due to being better supported by the industry players. And of course, to manage the industry in a way that all players will be well equipped to make a living. When the user contribution is sought, it's also a sign that we might need open code, open infrastructures, open blueprints and product designs, and to bring together a global community, which is the most important, to discourage political maneuvering, and when the issue, when the product or service is so critical, just in the case of zero emission of vehicles, pharmaceuticals based on decryption of DNA, that we need collaborative cooperation amongst industry players and the people. The competitive advantages are user and customer empowerment, internet-enabled collaboration demands, new models of production and new modes of cooperation, and libre software, and that process demonstrates that you can access a huge pool of people, a huge pool of resources without any central authority, as long as you remain open and as long as you encourage democratic forum for discussion. As far as libre software is concerned, there is a culture of innovation since the very early days of computer systems and the hacker culture, which dates back to the 50s or earlier than that. As far as management is concerned, we should move from hierarchical management by objectives, from command and control hierarchies and rules, to collaborative management by community consensus, and from corporate governments and central planning to community governments. What is the glue that sticks the whole network together, that sustains this form of working, of cooperation? Is healthy competition within and between projects, mainly the license seeks to ensure that you might take code that some other organizations contributed, but you have to give your version of the product back to the same community so that others can take also parts and bits of your code. Decentralization, when revolving around the community goal, is always the short objective. We have parallel development, we stress that. Accountability, that no one should be able to dictate his will without relying upon, without resting on the community, without resting on what people really want. And we need community ethics, which means ethics for environmental and social and organizational sustainability. The old economy paradigm was about companies employing people to do projects, whereas nowadays it's increasingly people or projects being brought together to start new industries and new careers. It's exactly up. What are the preconditions we need to set, we need to make sure they exist in order for this decentralized internet-enabled development to take place? We need websites, we need internet cyberspaces open to everyone that can create awareness around a specific project and to build community, to tie people closely so that a common goal will be followed. I'm using this scratching itch used by Eric Raymond. As I said in the beginning, the purpose of technology, so as not to be confusing, so as to be helpful, should be to serve clearly identified needs. Therefore, we need always to aim at enforcing technology where it's useful, not just for the sake of technology. We shouldn't do something boring, because if it's boring, apparently, not many people will be interested. And we should have modular and simple designs so as to enable people to study the operation of the code or the product design and build upon the product design. Clean interfaces, therefore. We need a license. That's a bit tricky. The way I see it, only a very simple and very strict license will do the job. We shouldn't leave any windows for misinterpretation, for misunderstanding of what the license means. The purpose of the license should not be to make profits or to manipulate the community into giving us a good product to start with and make money. It should be to enable the collaboration of people, and it should make people to believe that their input, their effort is being taken into careful account and it's not going to be exploited against their will, of course. Whether it's going to be exploited commercially, it's something logical. You should delegate responsibility, enable people to take action, and release early and often. That's, of course, modular and simple. You don't need it to be cutting edge. You don't need it to be almost perfect for other people to join in. Is this model applicable, amenable to be implemented in other industries? Like education, the music industry, the automobile industry, telecoms, pharmaceuticals, banking. I'll go into some detail in some of them, just simply scratching the surface. You people will help me take that to another level. When education becomes lifelong learning. A few weeks ago, MIT innovated in terms of creating a website dedicated to the MIT Open Courseware pilot. The way I saw it was a means to provide academics with a way to cross-compare academic courses, to see the structure that courses at different institutions and universities follow. But it was not deployed to facilitate and promote learning, individual learning. A good approach would have been a decentralized and modular web-based learning environment where different actors would be able to contribute and modules, applications. I've been working on product development, and nowadays, since development is almost done, on the marketing of a learning platform used primarily for distance learning courses and then for teaching purposes whatsoever. My recommendation to the president of the organization was open code, the base platform, have clean interfaces, and perhaps make money, since that was the objective of the organization, to make money from a closed code end-user application. Perhaps that is the graphical user interface or any other application. The point is, if the infrastructure, the technology that powers the learning environment is open, many universities will be able to adopt it without paying any money, which is very significant, very fast, and without any hesitation that would relate to paying money, quite extravagant amounts of money, for a distance learning platform. And then if you want to make money and everyone's adopted your own system, I bet you'll be able to sell the closed source application. As far as universities, which was the customer of this specific case, other people, of course, will be able to develop their own open code alternatives, run them at their own universities, perhaps in Africa, where money does not suffice to pay additional fees and to buy products and applications. Of course, we need well-defined interfaces again. Let's go to the automobile industry. This blog, Dan Barber, had told me that these days the car industry is marketing-driven. People buy cars because of the brand name, mainly, and because of some features they like, whether that's safety bug, or because that's a nice automatic... what's the name, Graham? The lever, the gears, automatic gear box. What he's saying is that if all organizations in the automobile industry could collaborate to create a clean energy, a clean and therefore environmentally sustainable engine, and then take that product design, which is open to everyone, everyone could take it and use it, and build upon it features that people would value, then it would make great sense. What I'm saying is that nowadays in California, there's an initiative by the state which says by year 2003, 10% of all cars sold should be zero or nearly zero emission vehicles. That's a great thing. If all states would adopt such a line of reasoning, absolutely by year 2003, the world would have been less dirty, at least not more dirty, because of car fumes. The problem and opportunity I see is that innovation is not restricted in scale and scope. For example, there are many solutions. It's not just Californian initiative. It's not just government regulation. A mixture of industry innovation and consumer demand will invoke that innovation to take place, will drive environmental sustainability and not just government-based schemes. Unfortunately, on the same page, because innovation has been sought in many different directions, takes many years for such an innovation to prevail, to come into range. We might have to wait till the year 2050, according to some nowadays estimates, which probably will be off topic in a couple of years. What can we do about it? Sincerely, I think that's good that innovation has been sought in many domains. But, however, that's the point where government can play a role. If a product design is being deemed nowadays as useful, then the government should build on that, at least as far as public services, public means of transport are concerned. Financing social capital. For those in the finance world, they know the term community development banking. SoarBank, situated in Chicago, is an innovative company because it started without many funds and started in neighborhoods struck by poor living conditions, by non-existent entrepreneurship, by people who had given up hope. Within a space of 2 to 3 years, they reinvigorated the community. Why? As Ron, I can't pronounce his name, I'm sorry. Must be, I don't know, RNZ, too difficult. Ron, anyway, said that we viewed this invested community as a market phenomenon. And therefore, to reinvigorate community, we should reinvigorate markets. But the relationship between markets and community is that these things are so inextricably linked to each other that one cannot exist without the other. A nice theme I'd like to touch upon very briefly is that the Free State Project. I came across that a week ago at Slashdot. At the moment, 1,000 people, more or less, have been joined their efforts to move on to a different state. I think it's somewhere in Canada to create a new life, to create a new democracy, whereas that's why they call it the Free State Project. And once there will be 20,000 people, they will move on to that state. The purpose I'm saying that is not because these people are freedom-loving, we're all freedom-loving, is that because we see people, and increasingly more people, realize that there are some drawbacks related to modern political life, to modern organizational life, and want to make a change. We do not have to create this change ourselves. We just have to make the best possible to create the preconditions, the clean interfaces, the parallel development version, the democratic forum, so that these people can coordinate themselves for that free state, for that free world society to emerge. That's also something very nice. I had this discussion with Andy Oram because of an article he wrote for the O'Reilly Network a week ago. That's really recent stuff, I just came across it. And he wrote about how human rights relates to free software. He says that accountability and verification is central to human rights. Why? Just like elections, you need to have accountable designs so that people cannot dispute or cannot debate the accountability of the outcome. You conform to scientific requirements, which means that by adhering to the libre software process out there in the open, it's exactly the scientific process taking place for many centuries. You release one's work, other people can test it, can build upon it, can debate it, so that scientific progress moves on. And of course, quality. The example is that some human rights workers might work under very difficult circumstances, whereas there is an organization or technician to support it, to provide some sort of technical support. Therefore, only by having open code and, of course, the technical knowledge to tinker with the software, you can correct it yourself, you can fix it, so that you are still at the mountains, but you can have your work with you. In a similar vein, Ivan Birney of the Human Genome Project talks about bioinformatics. You probably are acquainted with the reasons why in open source or in bioinformatics most people deploy Perl. There is no Microsoft Word equivalent. Scientific processors said But it's not the software, it's not the tools that's important. It's the data sets that resides within the software. So by being able to have an open design, you can take the data sets of another experiment, of another project, integrate it, and achieve greater accountability and insight, of course. There is an article by Felix Stalder saying that newsfeed sources, just like Slashdot, just like Newsfold, Spellmanx, no logo website devoted to the anti-globalization community, are based on an infrastructure called, most widely referred to as weblog. Others call it collaborative filtering or social navigation. The thing is that it's entirely different means to embark on journalism. You say your own opinion, and as long as not an individual weblog, it's a community weblog, others can debate and therefore have a more concrete opinion as to what's going on. NerdTV is a TV series by Robert Cringely. And from now on, it will be able to download it in many versions. One will be just audio version, and the other ones will be extended or shorter according to what you want. Even though television and filming involves some financial resources, especially for broadcasting, nowadays you do not have to focus upon broadcasting. Create something cheap by a webcam, perhaps, put it on the web for people to easily download it and perhaps modify it. It's gonna be funny anyway to see the result of that effort. I'd like to finish with that. In many organizations, in many industries where customization of the product and the service is sought, we need to have a variability in the product design and an organizational structure as well. The key word is variability. When the service is thought to be required to be customized, when customers will want to customize the product according to their own needs, according to their own desires, then there is no purpose in implementing rigid and stable organizational structures just like the bureaucratic authority. We need more fluid entrepreneurial designs which will take place out there in the open and will take advantage of the product design and of the market needs to give rise to better products, to more useful products and services. Thank you all for coming. It's quite an honor that you all showed up here, and thanks God, just one person fell asleep this time, or not even one. It's no problem. It's quite happening. I know the time, it's 5 o'clock. I once heard my speech, and I don't really like it. That's why I mostly apologize. I'm quite better when it comes to writing stuff than doing presentations. Anyway, thank you for coming, and if you do have any questions, please go on.
Am I right? You basically arguing that open source would be a step forward in business community that makes the world better? Or you, because obviously I'm not sure how far your arguments, but it's about why I'm just basically saying open source for business community makes this world better. If that is the case, then why do you think from the beginning this industry started from the military itself, from the competition? And why at the beginning, or part of the best part of the business, is closed society? Your suggestion?
I'll explain to you what I mean. When my father grew up, he wanted to be identified as part of a mass. They had mass products to be associated with, they had mass markets, and they had mass television to serve the needs of mass. Advertising was mass business. Nowadays, people do not want to be identified as part of the mass. They want individuality, they want their own individual expression, We see
when it was your father grew up in the mass society or mass production.
In both, he was born in 1933.
The 1933 wasn't anything like that from history. 1933 was a crisis period which led to the war.
Yeah.
I mean, it couldn't. Usually, people talk about old days as a good days, but that's not true. But what I can't understand is the project itself. Is there are two arguments basically: open source or free software.
That's a different subject. You should have told me what you wanted me to explain. When I'm saying open source, I'm not saying it with respect to Eric Raymond's view. My personal view, and I'm not biased, and I'm not, of course, ashamed for that, is that open source is, to put it gently, a way to exploit the resources provided by the free software community to make money. But I use sometimes the term open source because it's more like a verb. I cannot say I want to free software that car, but I can use as an analogy, I want open source or open code this car. That's why the title of my presentation originally was Open Sourcing Innovation, but I changed it to Open Coding Innovation. I do not make a political differentiation between open source and free software. In my mind, the community is the same, just the people and the organizations who try to exploit them differ. You asked me, does this suffice cover your question? Or
I'm not sure, no, but I think it's quite a contradiction of what you're presenting, basically. You're touching the benefits of internet and partially using the benefit of being open source, but you use the examples of benefits of internet in general, like for example you were given about the United Nations workers getting in touch with each other, email, just 1 second. They can be done through Microsoft software, no problem. Since internet, there are millions and millions more people that can get in touch with there are millions of more community. But that does not necessarily mean we are better off. Or the whole world community is not better off. What is important to distinguish between missing the point, whether you are as an individual for the open source or for the free software. And when we talk about free software, that itself, by its nature, is in contradiction with the capitalist or competition society. If where the company, no matter what format, the competition brings some sort of closeness. The reason why Microsoft codes are encoded, or it's not open, because in order to advance in the market, you have to have something secret, you know, against your competitors. Otherwise, it will be cooperation, which will be totally different from what the are.
I would have said I partly agree with you, but I don't really. I mean, many systems, even Microsoft in some respects, thrived, is so successful because most industry players embraced it. Most industry players could build applications that run on top of the Windows platform. That's, of course, an irony because many interfaces are hidden, many apps are not so well documented. What I'm trying to say with this presentation is that the main point you said, that competition brings closeness, should no longer be the point. We can have more useful rather than just dynamic and nice technology by having it open, and we can make sure that everyone can somehow collaborate, somehow invest his own time and effort into understanding what's the social, environmental, and human impact of technology in organizations. And unfortunately, sometimes institutions just serve to make institutions live forever. I mean, you shouldn't forget that, as you probably said, organizations and political systems did not exist since the dawn of time. We see nowadays that lots of people say, go back to old ideas, go back to the nuclear family. But the nuclear family is not existent in the 15th or 16th or 17th or even 18th century. We need society to progress upon some elements that provide for better value for the people and for society. And if that's feasible, time will prove it.
No, it is not feasible. The part of business now, which is under pressure from the quote funds, now is jumping on the open source in order to compete with others. But nonetheless, in the process, they're going to
close
their own society as well. Because that is the part of the competition. That is the nature of the competition. No matter how much moral you are asking people to stick to morality, but that competition will drive you in order to close part of your... that's why you can compete. Otherwise, if you don't, or someone listens to that kind of morality, you will close. That's the good cooperation. Then in that respect, it's a totally different. Then you have to touch someone's culture.
I'll provide just one minor example. It's very interesting. Sorry for not letting you say it. We see some entrepreneurs to be highly successful, not because they have an idea, not because they go on to doing something by themselves. We see the Silicon Valley to be so successful in terms of organizational structure, despite what's happened recently with the whole techno bubble. The organizational structure upon which Silicon Valley was based on was so successful because institutions, implying venture capitalists, had been supplying wholeheartedly people with money, universities had been conducting world-class research and at the same time providing people with skills and technologies to build upon, who had the same financial market been embedded into the whole theme, who had been seeing so many people, engineers, managers, technologists, financial people being brought together just for a project, putting together an organization just to market, to bring to market a product or a service, perhaps make it to a public company and then disband once the project had come to an end. Or just like Hollywood, I mean, how these people collaborate so closely with others and they do not close their code as far as I'm again jumping off the situation. All I'm saying is that competition, perhaps nowadays, perhaps for this century, has been promoting closeness, especially in the Western world, so that profits can come from intellectual property, can come from exploiting others. To provide you money so that you can write them back with your own knowledge. But in industries where the project is so significant, you need to have most players to come together. You need to have... the software industry is classic. You need to have developers, independent companies, developing applications for you. You need to have cross-compatibility across platforms. You need to have the support of the whole industry. The only way to gain that support very easily, very quickly, without buying them off, is by having an open infrastructure that everyone can trust by seeing how it works and by making sure it's never going to be closed by the developer. Whether it's feasible or not, again, I think time will show us. Please. Please.
I have a very stupid question, but in this community, when we talk about legal software, and I was used to the term free software, is there any ideological reason why?
I like liberal software because it speaks directly to the issue. It's liberal, as if freedom. It's not liberal as in free without costing any money. That's why I favor the term.
Where's that expression coming from?
Libre software.
Yeah.
As far as I know, it comes from the Libre software people based on the ABUL organization in Bordeaux, France. The president of the organization Pierre is a very nice guy who, because of having understood this tension that the word free creates sometimes, and that the term open source has even taken to an entirely new level. I mean, some people, by hearing open source, say, ah, I'll give you an example. 3 months ago, I met this guy. His name was Wolf, and because I already knew a guy called Wolf, who's a member of the open source research community, I stopped and asked him, excuse me, are that guy who's a member of the open source research community? That guy instantly despised me. He jumped like that back, says, look, I have nothing to do with open source, and I do not want to work with open source people. I didn't say anything else. I mean, that was his reaction. And I don't want people to fragment into politically based groups, whereas all of us are trying to extend the principles and methods inherent in a free and free as if liberal society to other areas of economic life and social life apart from software. Please.
You mentioned that there are ethical and ecological and social standards for the development of liberal software projects.
Yeah.
Do you consider that they are sufficient for guaranteeing that there is a move or a shift towards a better world?
I think that.
Innovation, this is the question.
Yeah.
Are these people better people than others, or are these people better than others?
That was the theme that pervaded my presentation, that if you have laid down the foundations, the preconditions for that growth to take place, and you make sure that technology aims at satisfying clearly identified needs, then social accountability, environmental, ecological sustainability, and human rights will evolve with it. Perhaps some people, when writing software, do not think of the ecological impact or about the human rights, but in their own way, they affect it.
But it will be well communicated to many tasks who develop these new products and services.
Yeah, that's true, but again, the way we deploy technology. Of course, it's a shift of mind frame. If perceptions do not change, nothing can change. I mean, this is where everything starts from. Unless people change their own perceptions, decide that it's time they can act, they can contribute the slightest effort so that something big one day might emerge, nothing can happen. Everything starts from perception, from mind frame, for how people regard themselves within the wider realm of society and organizational life. I mean, some people might like to work for an organization that takes your work and never gives you credit for anything, apart from the salary you get. But I don't, and other people do not as well. Therefore, there are grounds for hope that since some common perceptions are starting to mold, to change, the internet exemplifies that. One reason why the internet was so overestimated, let's say, at some point during the techno bubble, during the dot-com bubble, was that it promotes the idea of self-managed work. You'll work from home, you'll have a more independent attitude towards work and employment, and therefore we can say that technology impacts upon perceptions and changes perceptions, and slowly these perceptions, if been harnessed in a community sensitive manner, then we can hope that the new perceptions, the evolution of these perceptions, because perceptions is a community process, a social process, will be for the greater social and environmental good as well.
Do you think this process of changing the perception will run by itself, or it has to be fueled?
It has to be fueled. Nothing happens by itself. The issue is, how can we fuel, how can we trigger the process to take off? I don't think we can by means of dictating or by a government regime or by saying that, look, all organizations are illegal and they should be distracted. They should collapse from starting from tomorrow onwards. We can just put some conditions in place, as you said, some enable people to collaborate, and then these people will shape how they want the world to be. If they do not want it to be environmentally sustainable, then it's not upon me, you know, to dictate how technology will be used. Perhaps some people do not care about the impact of technology on humankind, on human rights. It's not within my hands to decide upon that. And there is no way that we can uniformly influence the process I was talking about. We can just hope, once the preconditions are in place, that people will become more sensitive, will sympathize with community-based goals, and will push this process to give rise to more sustainable organizations, products, and services, and institutions, of course. Anyone else? Then I suppose that was it. It's very nice I was here. Thank you for letting me speak so much, for not throwing any tomatoes or eggs or anything else, not even pencils. It was a great pleasure. Thank you, everyone.